early reviews are in for the final installment of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. The Guardian says The Dark Knight Rises is a bruising final stanza that ends the tale on a note of thunder. Rolling Stone calls Christian Bale's Batman hypnotic and haunting, and Anne Hathaway's Catwoman dynamite, bringing welcome humor to a movie about to be enveloped in darkness. Well, there's more darkness than mirth in this scene, with Christian Bale as his alter ego billionaire Bruce Wayne dancing with Hathaway at a society ball.
You think all this can last? There's a storm coming, Mr. Wayne. You and your friends better batten down the hatches, because when it hits, you're all going to wonder how you ever thought you could live so large and leave so little for the rest of us.
The Dark Knight Rises opens in theaters Friday, and it's a far cry from the Batman of the 60s, in which Adam West as Batman and Burt Ward as Robin camp it up. In this scene, Batman dangling from a helicopter ladder over the ocean with a clearly rubber shark hanging from his leg.
Holy sardine!
Hand me down the shark repellent bat spray!
Well, if you prefer the new Batman, The Dark Knight, you have Michael Uslan to thank. As a child, he fell in love with comic books, then became an entertainment lawyer, pretty much with the goal of bringing a darker version of Batman to the silver screen. We spoke with him back in October when his memoir, The Boy Who Loved Batman, came out. He told us why he cringed at the original Batman series.
Just the fact that he had spray bat shark repellent,
yes.
Or maybe was dancing the Bat-toosie in the local Peppermint Lounge in New York City. You know, I grew up on comics. I'm the ultimate comic book geek. I'm the Batman fanboy. I had 30,000 comic books I collected by the time I was graduating high school. And for me, it was all about the integrity of the character, the way he was created in 1939 as a creature of the night stalking criminals from the shadows. When I was about in eighth grade, and it was a cold January night in 1966 when the TV show came on the air, I was thrilled initially because it was the first superhero on TV since George Reeves' Superman. The car was cool. It was in color, but I was horrified that the whole world was laughing at Batman.
Yeah.
It just killed me.
And you mentioned being, you know, in eighth grade. You take us back to a wonderful time in your book, a time in the 50s and 60s when kids like you rode bikes to the soda shop and paid a dime for their latest comic book. What was the obsession?
The stories I was reading every single week were about warriors versus demons and dragons and wizards, except they all wear spandex and capes in the comic books. Mm. And the other thing I think very, very strongly, it's about wish fulfillment. It's about alienation and acceptance. It's readers identifying with really, really great, strong protagonists with fancy superpowers that can light up the imagination of kids. And I think that was really the core of it for me.
But you also remind us of another period in history in the 50s when there was a campaign against comics. This was led by a Dr. Frederick Wortham, a psychiatrist who claimed that comics were part of a communist plot to subvert young people. And you actually had a friend's father burn his comics?
Oh, I did. And that was unbelievably fairly commonplace. Comic books were being burned in different cities. Parents would not let their kids read comics, would not let them bring them into the house. And when they did, they made sure they were thrown out or destroyed, which thus makes them so utterly valuable these days.
Well, Dr. Wortham in his best-selling book also claimed that they caused asthma because kids stayed inside to read them and that they led to homosexuality. And then you've got all this comic book paraphernalia that you collected, including a frame from a Batman comic book in which Batman and Robin wake up in bed together one morning. They're in the same bed. What was up with that?
Well, how about them Yankees? They're really doing well this year, aren't they? You know, from time to time in the naivety of the 1950s, there were some panels that squeaked through there that are kind of hard to explain in retrospect. But I think that the world is safe, and I know as far as my mom was concerned, she was convinced that I could read comics, that they sparked my imagination, they increased my vocabulary, and she was convinced that if I continued to read them and collect them, I would not become a juvenile delinquent nor a communist. So that seemed to have worked pretty well for her.
You go to law school, become an entertainment attorney, and then you quit because you're afraid you will never follow through on your dream of bringing Batman, the the true Batman story to the big screen. And the story starts to turn. You go out, you buy the rights. In 1979, you buy the rights to Batman, and no one wants to make it.
No. Every door slammed in my face. I was told I was crazy by every single studio in Hollywood. They told me it was a lousy idea. And for God's sake, you cannot make a movie based on some old TV series. That's never been done.
So you and your partner Ben Melnicker finally find Casablanca Films and Peter Guber and other producers who get it. And Tim Burton signs on. But then Tim Burton wants to cast Michael Keaton. Your reaction is understandable.
I was apoplectic.
Yes, well, there you go.
I was apoplectic. I had spent years and years and years to try to bring a dark, serious Batman to the screen. I laughed. I said, I can see the posters now. Mr. Mom is Batman. But Tim had a vision, and this is why he's a genius, because he realized that he had to convince audiences who have never seen a dark and serious comic book superhero movie before. He had to get them to suspend their disbelief and to believe in Bruce Wayne, that he was a man so obsessed to the point of being psychotic that audiences would honestly say, without laughing and giggling, yeah, that is a guy who would get dressed up as a bat and go out and do that. And he was so right about that. It made all the difference. That movie was so revolutionary and changed really the course of the business, and its influence, you could still see it reflected in genre films today.
It's just really quite something that you pulled it off. But your story also reminds us that it often doesn't stop at success. You know, for you, there were sequels after the Tim Burton Batman film. Who can forget Joel Schumacher's films with Val Kilmer as Batman or George Clooney as Batman? Actually, a lot of people are trying to forget.
I think a lot of people can forget.
What was happening there? You don't write a lot about this. Was this painful for you to see your dream devolve into these cheesier films? Or, you know, is this frankly a place where you push some bad things as a, you know, one of the people behind the film?
No. Sometimes in the industry, people become too fascinated with merchandising, toys, and Happy Meals. The concentration is, well, in order to satisfy toy companies, how many heroes and villains can be crammed into a movie? They must all have two costume changes and two vehicles. And all of a sudden, movies are not being made. Two-hour infomercials for toys are being made. My contention in the industry is if great filmmakers are working off of great stories and characters, they're going to sell toys anyway and go out and make great films. Warner Brothers totally gets this and thus brought in Christopher Nolan, who raised the bar for all comic book-based films. Because I think since Dark Knight and Batman Begins, audiences can walk out of a theater and instead of saying, gee, this was a great comic book movie, they can at last just say, this was a great film.
Michael Uslan, his memoir of growing up loving comics and then being the driving force to bring the story of Batman to the big screen, is called The Boy Who Loved Batman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Our producers today include Lynn Menegon, Hitesh Hathi, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Rachel Rohr, and Jill Ryan. Our interns are Joseph DiNatale, Sarah Faisal, and Alex Johnson of Brooklyn High School fame. Very well known there. Our technical director is Doug Shugarts. Chris Ballman is the managing editor. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.